Hey, this is Fred. And before we begin, I want to tell you about two new podcasts from smarterpodcasts.com. Radio Baseball Cards, hosted by Hall of Fame pitcher Don Drysdale, are two-minute episodes featuring the greatest baseball players of the 20th century telling stories of their lives in and around the game. As we move from All-Star Game memories in July, we approach the dog days of August with two episodes a week, all month long, to continue our celebration of Jackie Robinson breaking baseball's color barrier in 1947. We have stories from teammates like Roy Campanella and Duke Snider, opponents including Bill Rigney on Jackie's first major league home run, and players from the 60s, 70s, and 80s who saw Jackie as a ray of hope and inspiration. And our other new show is called Good Dog. Think of Good Dog as golf smarter for dog owners. Host Joanne Green, a self-proclaimed dog nut, focuses on dog behavior, training, choosing a breed, care and feeding, and more. So if you're a dog owner like me, who actually listens to podcasts while walking the dog, then I urge you to check out the Good Dog Podcast in iTunes, the Apple Podcast app, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Golf Smarter, number 600. Yay!
The internet is killing golf instruction, and probably your game, with our old buddy, Jim Waldron.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Mr. Jim Waldron.
Thank you, Fred. Great to be back for whatever it is, the 12th time or something like that, I think.
Actually, this is the 18th appearance that you've made on Golf Smarter.
Yeah,
there are many times that when we were doing the members-only episodes, we would do 2 weeks in a row, two episodes in a row. So there's a lot of those. But all the way back to 2007, December of 2007, episode number 105 was the first time you were on. And I'm not going to list all the episode numbers, but I will list them in the show notes so that if anybody is so compelled to hear more on a daily basis, if you want to hear, there's 18 episodes with Jim. Wow. You can go back and you will learn a tremendous amount about golf instruction and about how to improve your game. Jim, the Balance Point Golf Schools that Jim runs and Jim himself have always been one of my, clearly 18 times, clearly one of my favorite guests.
Yeah, and I enjoy being here talking with you. It's always fun, even if it's over a Thai meal.
Exactly. Episode number 400.
We did at a restaurant, a Thai restaurant in Portland, over dinner. That was cool.
That was so much fun, and the people are looking at us like, what are you doing over there? It's like, just serve us. We're eating and we're talking. And so episode 400.
Like the golf version of the great independent movie, My Dinner with Andre.
Right. It was My Dinner with Jim and your dinner with Fred.
Yeah.
So we've talked for many hours while recording at the same time. But I'm really curious to talk to you today about what you've witnessed with the internet and golf instruction. I mean, it's got to be a completely different world for you when you meet somebody for the first time who's interested in a golf coach, golf instructor, and they come in with all this stuff that they've, well, you know, on the Golf Channel, I learned this. And then I was watching YouTube, and then I got hooked on this guy on YouTube. And then I was listening to a podcast. Oh, don't do that. And right. So all this information that's coming, that's bombarding us in the internet, has that been a positive thing for golf instruction?
Yes and no. Although I would say if you had to quantify it, mostly negative. And I'll tell you the reason why. So, and I won't go into a lot of detail on the history of how golf evolved as a sport in this country, but let's just say it evolved as a sport in a way that was radically different than other sports evolved. And we've always had a situation prior to the internet where about, in my case, when I started teaching 25 years ago, about 20% of my new students suffered from a pretty big issue I use the term contamination, which basically means over-reliance on the intellect to monitor or to create new body movement patterns when you're swinging at normal speed. So people know, the thing that people do when they go to the practice range and on the golf course is they use quote-unquote swing thoughts, right?
Yeah.
But there are no forehand thoughts in tennis. There are no free throw thoughts in golf, or sorry, basketball. There are no parallel turn thoughts in downhill ski racing, right? In other words, in other sports, the idea that you would somehow use thoughts, the thinking part of your brain, to guide you through doing the proper body movement pattern, it's just not that idea would be crazy in other sports. No one would teach that way, right? But that's the way golf always was taught. And it was mainly the province of the golf magazines that were selling, you know, they were trying to sell, obviously, advertising, but also issue subscriptions to Golf Digest, Golf Magazine. And, you know, the bulk of the content would be instructional. And typically it was an oversimplified Band-Aid type of tip, you know, the tip, famous tip of the month type of thing. And so we would get, you know, like I said, about 20% of my students would be kind of like addicted to the golf magazines and thinking, if I just get my elbow to rotate 20 degrees when I start my downswing, or, you know. So I would spend some time with that guy or gal, showing them, you know, you need to like learn that it's a sport. It's not a mechanical engineering problem that you can solve with math, with equations, with thinking. It has much more to do with awareness of how your body's moving through space, and awareness in direct, what I call empirical consciousness, or sometimes I call it meta-awareness using feel, where you can focus on what your body is actually doing, right, as it moves through space. That's the starting point for getting better at golf, having that level of you know, proprioception or feel channel awareness for what your current body motion is actually doing. If you lack that skill, then it just becomes an intellectual exercise, which doesn't work, because again, it's about training your body to move in a new and more effective way. So that problem's gotten, it's like on steroids because of the internet. So now 80% of my students who come to see me, particularly if they're age 40 or younger, are extremely contaminated because of everything they see online.
Is there bad information that's coming out, or is just, are we being bombarded from multiple places that confuses us?
It's not so much the confusion is part of it, because sometimes, like you just mentioned, some people just have, you know, they'll have four different swing thoughts and they all contradict each other. So that's what I just call that confusion. That's part of it. It's more the idea that, again, it's the state of consciousness that you're supposed to be in when you're trying to get better at golf is thinking, like you do for most people in our current economy use their thinking mind at work. So they're typically working, particularly if it's a white collar job, they're doing some type of sitting in front of a computer or sitting at a desk, and they're using cognitive thinking, cognition, to, you know, to make their living. And they apply that same state of consciousness to learning a highly complex motor skill like the golf swing. Well, it's just not going to work very well. You know, and people who have that issue don't even know that they have the issue. In other words, they think it's normal, because that the young generation of golfers that are coming up in the last, well, since the internet, in the last 15 years or so, that's all they know. They think, well, you know, you can go online on YouTube and search for information, and if the information sounds interesting, you can use that as sort of a template to guide your own solo, sort of self-directed trial and error learning when you go to the practice range, right? You try this, you try that, but the problem is it's mostly, if not entirely, at the level of thought, and as opposed to the level of awareness. Now, awareness and thought are not the same thing, right? There's a way you can use your mind to directly experience with some level of accuracy, some high degree of accuracy, how your body actually moves. And then there's a symbolic type of consciousness, which is thinking is, where you're seeing in your mind, sort of in your mental screen, you're seeing an image of how you want your body to move, a visual image. Or you're using language, you're repeating certain phrases to yourself, like keep my left arm straight, for example, right? So you're using auditory images, language, words, and or you're using visual images, right, thoughts, visual images. And there's a preoccupation on that mode of consciousness and a dependence on that mode of consciousness. And the problem is your body could be doing something completely the opposite of what you're picturing. And oftentimes that's the case. So someone comes to see me and they've already self-diagnosed, usually incorrectly. And then what they think that they're trying to do with their intellectual mind, their body's not doing at all. So I have to actually put them on video, play it back in slow motion. And I'll say, okay, what swing thought were you using here? And the guy will say something like, well, I was telling myself to stay down, to stay in my spine angle. And of course, when you play it back in slow motion, he's raising up 8 inches. So at the exact moment in time, he's hearing a voice in his head say, stay down, right? His body's actually lifting up. But because he's paying attention to a voice in his head, not to the actual physical reality, what his body's really doing, he misses what his body's doing because he's listening to the voice in his head, right? Does that make any sense?
Yeah. So what's his reaction when he watches the video?
Stunned silence. Typically, like, oh my God, I had no idea.
Right. You know?
And again, this is not new. Every golf teacher in the world knows what I'm talking about. And again, it used to be something that was sort of more of a mild problem, but it's gotten so out of hand now because of the internet. Because people come with so much more intellectual knowledge. In other words, the average golfer today who goes online, researches the golf swing, has way more intellectual knowledge about the golf swing than the average teaching pro had 30 years ago.
Wow.
Way more.
Yeah.
The problem is a lot of it's conflicting information. So therefore, it not only does it not help, it actually makes you worse. In other words, if you're trying to create a swing motion, let's say you're working on your takeaway, but you're trying to do two different things in the takeaway that basically are opposite, right? In other words, they don't complement each other. Then your takeaway is not only not going to get better, it's actually going to get worse. In other words, certain components are incompatible with other swing components.
Ouch.
You really have to be a teaching pro to have that level of knowledge to know what those incompatibilities are. The average person has no chance to know that.
Hmm. Are you an advocate of getting a golf instructor and staying with one instructor? Or do you think that it's a good thing for people to have multiple, let's just say, face-to-face instruction?
Definitely, it's crazy to have more than one teacher in a short frame of time. Mm-hmm. That's just not an effective strategy. I think the basic rule is pick one teacher, commit to his or her model for a given length of time, depending on what your goals are. So if you have a long-term goal to be really good at, say, ball striking, which is the hardest of the four major skill areas, then I'd say give that person at least a year, if not longer, but at least a year, and work. And then if you feel at the end of that year that you're not close to having achieved your goal for the end of that year, and the reason is not you because you, for whatever reason, maybe, you know, you didn't practice enough or something. But in other words, if you put the practice time in and you aren't seeing the level of improvement that you had expected to, that you had made a goal with your teacher about, then you would consider going somewhere else for sure. But yeah, I think if you pick the right teacher to start with, there's definitely advantage to staying with his or her model for a fairly long time. Look at Rory McIlroy. So Rory's what, is he like 26 now, something like that, I think?
Mm-hmm.
And I think he started with Michael Bannon when he was 3, and he's still with Michael Bannon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could use the Asian martial arts parallel as well, right? So in the Asian martial arts tradition, if you really want to be really good, get to a black belt status, say in karate, or even, you know, advanced black belt, you'll probably stay with the same teacher for decades and just keep getting better and better at karate.
Okay, so my question was loaded because I wanted to then follow it up with, what's the major downside of finding an online instructor who's just making videos and giving a variety of tips on things, whether it be, and I'll mention people that have been on this show, from a Dave Pelz to a Jim Venetis to, you know, I mean, like, we can go on, these guys who have, Jeff Ritter, who have very, a rich catalog of content. So if you were to say, you know what, I'm just going to watch Jeff Ritter and make the turn from here on out. He's going to be my instructor, but I'm never going to talk to him. I'm just going to watch what he has to say and work from that. Does that work?
Again, it depends. So I hate to sound like a politician here, but I have to qualify my answer a little bit. Compared to what? Compared to not doing anything? Oh, let me put it this way. Compared to just trying to figure it out without a teacher, then obviously that's superior to not using a teacher.
Okay.
Comparing it to working with a teacher either in person or at least like I do with remote, you know, with Skype lessons where you can see each other in real time, then that option pales in comparison, right?
Yeah.
Meaning the option of just following one teacher online but never actually interacting with them. For the people out there who still believe in that, all I can tell you is the difference is so great. I don't know how many orders of magnitude the difference is. It's a lot. It's beyond night and day. The difference between actually working and having an ongoing dialogue with a good teacher versus watching that teacher's YouTube videos and trying to figure it out for the most part on your own. You can't even compare the two.
So the dialogue, the interaction with
teachers, way more important.
Yeah, the dialogue is the critical element here. The two way, having someone watching you.
99% of it. Yeah, for sure. Would you agree or no? What's your opinion on it?
Well, I'm not a golf instructor, and I have hundreds of golf instructors that have filled my head with insanity, and I still believe that every single instructor that I've ever interviewed believes that they have figured out Ben Hogan's secret. And my feeling is, who am I to dispute you? You know, I mean, it's like, if you think that you've got it, then that's awesome. Let me give you a soapbox to go ahead and talk about it. But I can't dispute that. I'm not a PGA instructor, right? I'm just a guy who has a lot of questions and loves to play the game and has a tremendous amount of questions about the game.
Well, you know, you could frame the question another way, which is if you were, let's say I was a piano teacher, and I guarantee you a piano teacher would agree that if you watch my YouTube videos and try to learn it by yourself, yeah, you will get some level of improvement. But if you come to see me in person or even if it's on webcam live where I have an actual interaction where you can ask me a question and I can answer it or I can point out something you're doing in your piano fingering technique that's wrong that you don't even know you're doing wrong, that is so much more effective. It's you can't compare the two, right? Mm-hmm. But again, the problem is there's a small enough percentage of the golfing population who are getting some level of moderate to significant improvement by using only online instruction. And of course, they tend to post online and say, oh, look at my swing now. Look how it is now compared to a year ago. It leaves, I think, the false impression that that's the norm. And I can tell you from working on both sides of it, that's not the norm. That's extremely unusual. It's probably less than 1% of golfers who attempt it achieve some level of moderate to significant improvement. And I'll give you an example of why that's so. Most people who come to see me, and not just me, every other teaching professional that I know, I've talked with about this, if they've been playing golf for, say, 6 months or longer, so they're not a total beginner, so they have some sense of what they're doing in their swing. Most people come to see me thinking they've already know what the problem is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost never the case that their self-diagnosis is accurate. Usually there's something else that's far more toxic in terms of a swing flaw than what they're identifying as their number one swing flaw. And it might be several things. It might just be one thing. It might be three or four different flaws that they don't even know they have. So, for example, just in the last week, I got back from 2 weeks in Ireland, and I did a week of teaching in Portland last week. And I had three students who fit this bill to a T. One of them, two of the three, their balance was so poor that literally on every swing, without exception, so let's say 95% of their swings, their balance was so poor that they would move their feet, particularly their right foot would go forward toward where the ball was because their weight was going so far toward their toes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when I asked them what they thought their number one swing flaw was, always something else. It was always over the top, or it was, you know, my wrist release, my wrist mechanics during release is wrong. It was always something kind of technical. But if you can't hold your finish in rock solid balance without your right foot moving, obviously it moves, it goes up on the toe, it rotates, you know, kind of 180 degrees up on the toe, but it doesn't, you know, you shouldn't actually move your foot. You shouldn't actually have to step forward because that means you're losing your balance, right?
Your right foot or your left foot for a right-handed golfer?
Right foot.
So it's 90 degrees, not 180 degrees, is it?
Well, I guess that's true. Yeah, 90 degrees.
Okay.
Right. It rotates 90 degrees, but not only does it rotate 90, but it goes up on the toe.
Right.
At a proper finish.
Right.
And it might slide, as it goes up on the toe, it might slide a few inches, like 6 inches or so along the ground. But I'm talking about somebody who actually, when they're halfway in their downswing, they have to step their foot out about 2 feet to not fall over.
Right.
Right.
I was
so
there.
Really, really poor belt. Yeah.
And I was there.
So that's like a real fundamental thing. Now, in both those cases, neither of those people knew, A, that they were doing it, or if they kind of knew it a little bit, they didn't think it was that important of a flaw.
Right.
Right. So they had self-diagnosed in a completely wrong way, you know, completely inaccurate way. Another person, the third student, she's actually a 12 handicap, and she's only been playing golf for 3 years, and she started in the middle eight, so that's unusual for her to get that good. But she still has some significant swing flaws, and one of them was she didn't rotate her hips at all, or virtually hardly at all, on the backswing.
Mm-hmm.
And in her case, she thought that was correct. Someone had told her you're not supposed to rotate your hips on the backswing, which is crazy. You have to have hip rotation of at least 45 degrees, particularly if you're average flexibility, to play good golf. So in her case, not only did she self-diagnose what their flaw was, she thought what she was doing was the right move, and it was actually a flaw. So she was trying not to let her hips turn at all on the backswing.
Mm.
Right? So that kind of stuff is pretty common nowadays in golf teaching. Because, again, there's so much information out there. And, again, some of it isn't, in my view, isn't correct. It's from a scientific point of view, it's kind of flawed, right? But even if the bulk of it was correct, if you're still in your head thinking about it and you're not paying attention with good meta-awareness of what your body's actually doing, then you're not going to have the learning and the performance breakthrough you want.
It's interesting. You know, I do not give golf instruction. I could not break down somebody's swing, but I've learned so much in this podcast and having these conversations. And based on the emails that I received, a lot of people learn a lot as well that have helped improve their game.
Sure.
But when it comes to the swing mechanics part, actually, I have a cute little story that happened, and I hope I'm not repeating myself, but that happened to me just a week or so ago. I was playing with these three guys in their 30s, early 30s, same age as my younger son. And I'm, you know, the one of the guys cannot get the ball off the ground. I mean, he's just rolling it 40, 50 yards, maybe at best. And I'm noticing, like, if I'm going to make suggestions to people, and I only will do it if I'm asking, do you mind if I make an observation? Like, you know, that you hit the ball exactly where you were pointing. You know, your body was pointing that way. Oh, okay. You know, but I'm not going to go, but your wrist, and because I'm not, first of all, I don't think it's fair to do that to somebody in a round of golf. You want to talk about it at the driving range, fine, but don't try to mess with people's swings during a round. Anyway, so I get into the conversation with one of these 30-year-olds, and we get to a point where we find out that this kid who can't get the ball off the ground, he wrestled in high school, as did my son, and I watched a lot of high school wrestling at that time. Well, this guy, I asked him, I kind of conjured up my very first golf lesson with a guy named Doug Acton, who I've done a video with him. He's never been on the show. I've done a video with him, and I've had a lesson with him, you know, last year as well. But Doug, in the very first lesson that he gave me, he asked me, what sports did you play as a kid? And from that point on, he related everything that we were talking about to those sports so I can get it in my own head what that means. So I'm talking to this kid who's not hitting the ball, and he's got, I ask him, you know, like, okay, think about wrestling. I said, where does your power come from in wrestling? And he said, your hips, your legs. And I went, right. Now look at your friend's golf swing. And this guy had a, you know, he made a full rotation, and he, you know, his hips turned, and he came through, and he followed through. The guy who I asked had no hip movement on the backswing at all,
sure.
None. And so when I said, when I asked him, and he said hips, I went, uh-huh. And he looked at me like, oh, I'm not moving my hips? I said, at all. You do nothing. I said, second question, show me a ready position for wrestling. And he got into a very athletic stance with one foot in front of the other, and he crouched down and his hands were out. It's like, right, now look at your setup position when you're about to hit a golf ball. And he basically stood straight up with his shoulders hunched over and just kind of like laid the club there. And I'm saying, so, you know, I'm just making an observation that you know how to do these things, but you're not utilizing it right now. He, at the 18th tee box, he said to me, I can't tell you what a change it's made for me, just you're mentioning the hips. And he broke 100 for the first time on that round.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so he was crushing the ball from that point on, and he was thanking me. And I'm like, okay, so I'm an instructor. All right, fine.
Did he pay you for that lesson? You should charge him.
No. I would never do that to anybody. Should I?
No.
No, don't. Don't do that, Fred. Yeah. I'll be a high school golf coach at some point, but I won't tell anybody that I've been faking it on TV for years. I'm curious about TV coverage, pre-internet, post-internet, and what it's done just by watching people play golf on TV and then going onto a golf course and saying, well, I know what I'm doing wrong because Phil doesn't do that. Or, you know, or the guy on the Golf Channel told me I you know, shouldn't be doing that. But the TV coverage and the announcers, and they're trying to break it down, making us think, like, if we pay attention to these guys, we'll be able to improve our game.
Yeah, I think it's, if you look at information as a commodity, which in our economic system it is, right? You especially if you pay for it, if you purchase it. You know, I think the basic idea that I'm critiquing this idea because I think it's hurting people. In fact, I know it's hurting people. You know, it's impeding by the average golfer's ability to achieve their goals. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. Which is, if I can just find the right information, I mean literally intellectual information. So the right words, if I'm reading a magazine article or a book, or the right video images if I'm looking at YouTube or a television show on the golf swing. That if I have that information consciously at my fingertips, somehow I'll be able to translate that information into significantly better body and club motion, right? Which then creates better impact, which gives you a better ball flight. The problem is, except in the very early stages of learning, that doesn't help very much. So I always say, swing theory doesn't even get you in the ballpark, but it gets you heading north in the general direction. The ballpark's 10 yards north of where you are, and it gets you heading north. That's all it does. It doesn't get you in the ballpark of actual really, really learning how to improve your golf swing, for example. Hmm. You know, and I think people my age, your age, and a little older sort of kind of understand that, but there's definitely a generational thing about this. And the younger generation thinks, if I just get the right information, somehow it'll make me a better golfer. Now, here's what we're seeing because of that not being actually a true statement. We're seeing very high quit rates for new golfers, the highest they've been in probably ever. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons people say they play it for 6 months or a year, then they quit. And the reason they give is too hard. Mm-hmm. Didn't get close to achieving the goals I wanted to achieve, right? I'm still topping the ball a year later, for example. You hear that a lot. The other thing that happens is it tends to give people the yips, which we talk about.
About that.
I'm getting so much more. I've seen an increase in the last year of 300% over the previous year of the number of people from all over the world who contact me who have the yips.
Wow.
And it's almost exclusively people around early 40s or younger.
Wow.
So, you know, and that's what happens when, you know, there's other causes for the yips besides contamination, but contamination, over-reliance on the thinking mind to try to create better body motion is usually how most people start out on that path that leads eventually to the yips. And they'll tell you, I can't get over it. I just talked to this gal yesterday, she's a professional, teaching professional. We talked for like an hour, and she's got a bad case of the short game yips. She's like super tee to green. But when she walks up to a chip shot, she's terrified. And she goes through a litany of all these different swing thoughts, hoping that one of them will somehow work like magic to prevent her from yipping. Right?
But is this someone who would be practicing their short game off the course?
Say that again, Fred?
Is this someone who's going to be practicing their short game off the course, or are they just going to be hitting balls as far as they can every time?
Are you talking about the person that has the yips?
Yeah. Dealing with? Yeah.
No, she's actually very good on the course, except with short game. She can do. She's very good off the course in the short game practice area if she's alone. But if there's other people watching, when she's practicing, she'll yip. Every single time on the golf course, if she has a short game shot, she'll yip. So she has a severe case of it. But the point I'm trying to make is when you think about golf and getting better at golf as a merely intellectual exercise, which is what most people who spend time on sort of the internet golf land, right? That seems to be the default sort of consciousness, that if I just can find the right information. And I always tell people, you know, I get people all the time who I give them the right information in the first 10 minutes of, a 2-hour lesson, right? But if they're like an average golfer, someone who's maybe like a 12 handicap to maybe a 25 handicap in that range, even if they intellectually understand it really well at the end of the 10 minutes, which they almost always will, it might take them the rest of that 2-hour lesson to get to a level of their body actually doing it in a reasonable fashion, right? So there's a gap between merely intellectual understanding and actually getting your body to execute properly. And people go, well, what fills the gap? And I go, that's the dialogue part. That's the interaction between the student and the teacher in real time, where there's questions, where there's answers, where I demonstrate, where they demonstrate, I give them feedback. It takes a while for that purely intellectual ideal information to translate into the student's body actually making a new and more effective motion. And that almost never gets discussed in the online golf community. It's just like it's not even there.
Well, yeah, I think that because of the internet and how easy it is to get video, that most people are going to be looking at videos to get information on how to hit a golf ball. But, I'm kind of proud of the fact that we've really spent a tremendous amount, maybe because it's just audio, but that this program, I've been able to focus a lot on the mental and emotional part of the game, golf smarter, right? Instead of just golf better.
Or golf technical.
Yeah, golf technically. Technical golf. And maybe it works better because of a conversation that we can talk about this, but I don't know if I've ever seen a video online of someone giving course management instructions on the golf course.
Some of that could be because by the nature of if you actually had the camera follow you around doing a playing lesson, that would be kind of cool to see. I do a lot of playing lessons in the summer at Quail Valley.
I bet. I would love to have. I've done, I've been out on the golf course with people who I've interviewed, and then it's like, oh, well, just give me a lesson here and I'll follow along and I'll videotape this. And, I did this with Jamie Zimron a couple months ago. It's on our YouTube channel. Where I got a playing lesson and really learned, even though we've talked about it for so much, learned what it meant to be in balance at the finish of a swing. Oh, and it's changed my game.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the thing about the playing lesson is that what you find as a teaching pro is that typically I work mostly in the range. So let's say we do like a 2-hour range session, and then we go like from 5:30 to 7 in the evening, we'll go out and play golf. We'll play 5 holes for 90 minutes when the course isn't crowded, right, in the summer. And typically, not always, but I'd say 9 out of 10 students, significant decline in performance when they walk on the tee box compared to the driving range. And again, that's because they don't know how to use their mind, their mental focus, and how to control their emotions, right? And so they get too excited, they try too hard, they kind of get in their own way. And a lot of the playing lessons about that aspect of the mental game. How you have to, to hit a golf shot well consistently, you have to be in that Mr. Spock, Vulcan, non-emotional, or very calm, cool mindset, right? Where you, like Spock will say, "The warp drive is about to explode, Captain."
Fascinating.
Hogan talked about this a lot. He used the term "don't add yourself to the shot." Someone asked him years ago.
Wow.
In an interview, they said, "What's the biggest difference between your game and the mid to high handicap executives to come out and pay a lot of money to play in the Wednesday pro-ams on the PGA Tour?" Right. and he thought about it for a long time. You know, Hogan was very, very kind of a pensive, kind of a quiet, thoughtful person. And he thought about it for about 30 seconds, just sat there. He said, the biggest difference is they get ready to pull the trigger and start their backswing. And from that point all the way into the finish, they keep adding themselves to the shot-making process. He said, I try to remove myself. And what he meant was what we call emotional disengagement. He figured out early in his career that if he could be emotionally disengaged from not only the swing itself, but from the shot outcome, you know, which shot outcome represents either really, really great success or dismal failure, right? So particularly failure, people are afraid of failure. And if you're trying to prevent failure from happening on an emotional level, you're going to add yourself emotionally to the swing, right?
Hmm.
And what that means is it weakens the brain-mind-body connection, which tends to make you flinch. And in the golf world, flinch is another term for yip. It literally means a mild intensity yip,
mm-hmm.
right? And so but that's what people do. They because they add themselves emotionally, they end up flinching a little bit or even a lot on any particular shot. And then, of course, the flinch ruins the shot. So that's one of my favorite stories about Hogan. He kind of figured that out, I think, probably as a kid, that if you can detach yourself emotionally from the outcome of the shot and just sort of go through your routine step by step and don't worry too much about the outcome, right?
Yeah. No, that was one of our shows, NATO. Not attached to outcome.
Yeah.
NATO
yeah,
golf.
It's really important. Yeah. It's really important.
Amazing.
Again, that's not a skill you're going to learn in any school in the United States or anywhere else
right.
in the Western world.
Right. And you won't find a lot of podcasts about it because they're all talking about the tour.
Yeah. No, I think that's a key aspect of performance, particularly athletic or music performance or dance, things that involve your body. You know, learn body complex movement patterns to execute and let the subconscious mind control the body with total surrender is a really, really big deal in golf. But again, not too many people are talking about it because it's almost like a dying art.
Yeah.
You know. Mm. Yeah. In fact, I've got a student who came to see me last summer for our 3-day great shot school. And it was interesting because his swing was already way better than the scores he was shooting, like way better.
Hmm.
But he couldn't, as soon as he went out on the golf course, you know, the time we weren't sure it was a yips because I didn't have a chance to play with him. We just did the school on the range. And he got significantly better by the end of the 3 days. But his scores didn't come down very much. He still had these sort of huge blow-up rounds where he would shoot over 100. If you saw this guy swing in the range, you'd think he probably shoots like in the mid-70s, right? But we finally determined he actually has a case of the full-blown, you know, full swing yips, which we're going to work on in a couple of weeks in Portland.
Wow. Well, we did a couple of episodes. Yeah, you and I did a couple of episodes on the yips. And, you know, of the 18 shows that you've been on, 18 appearances you've made on Golf Smarter, not only will I list the show numbers in the show notes, but I'll also include the title. So if you want to go back and listen to any other of Jim's teachings, and they really are his teaching. They're conversations we're having, but I find them to be incredible teachings. I'll list the show title along with the show number, so that if you want to go back, you can check to see where those are. And you know, there's for if you're listening right now, this is beyond my conversation with Jim at golfsmarter.com. We also list. We have a tab that says archives. And it's just a Google spreadsheet that I keep updating with every show. And it has every show, the number, the day it was published, and what the title is and who the guest is. So you can always find that, again, at golfsmarter.com. Jim,
sure.
I am...
Can I say one more thing real
please,
quick?
Please, please, please. I'm sorry.
Okay. I just wanted to consider the listeners. So, you know, because this dichotomy in our culture, you know, the mind-body split that Plato wrote about and Aristotle wrote about and Descartes wrote about, it's real, right? When I give a podcast like this or even do a lecture or a clinic or something, and I go on and on about awareness and focus and how to learn, people think, oh, he's just doing sports psychology. He's not actually a golf teacher. I spend 80% of my time teaching people somewhere between moderately technical and highly technical mechanics, right? But I don't teach any of that detailed mechanics without first teaching people how to use their mind better. Because that's your main tool, right? You can't train your body without training your mind first. So first you learn how to use your mind better, more properly, more effectively, then you train the body. That's the sequence.
Well, I'm glad you added that. That was very special. Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, real quickly, Balance Point Golf Schools, where you are going to be, where you are, and how people can find you.
I'm in Portland, Oregon in the summer months. I'm in Honolulu, Hawaii in the winter months. I'll be doing a school just north of Puerto Vallarta the first 2 weeks of December at Little Blue Golf Course. And I'll be doing a school for the European audience right by the Dublin, Ireland airport in early June of next year.
Of 2018.
2018. I'll be doing about a week of teaching there.
And online, how can they find you?
Balancepointgolf.com. I do online lessons live via Skype or webcam or Hangouts. And I sell videos and ebooks on the golf swing and other aspects of the game.
Well, there you go. Didn't we do an episode once where we were like talking about an idea for a book that you were writing, and I suggested 18 chapters instead of 12 or something? I mean, whatever.
Yeah, I put that one on hold, but yeah, because it was 15. It was called the 15 Gates book.
Right.
That's about 75% done, but I've had other things happen that kind of push it further down the line in terms of importance. But yeah, you made the suggestion. Why not make it like 18, which is actually a good suggestion.
Get past 75%, you finish it and complete it and want people to know about it, you're definitely coming back to talk about it, and we'll get the audience, get copies out to them when it happens.
Sorry, man.
And thank you again for all the time that we've spent together, and coming on episode number 400, and now coming on episode number 600. That's how special you are in my Golf Smarter world, Mr. Waldron.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. It was always fun talking with you.
So as a podcast listener, I noticed something that's included on a lot of different shows, and it seems to be based on NPR, the National Public Radio programming model. It's something I've never done, but I'm going to honor it because this is episode number 600. So, our show today is produced by me, Fred Green. The engineer is me, Fred Green. The writer of our show notes is me, Fred Green. And graphic design, yeah, I do that too. Sponsorship sales by Jessica Kupferman and me, Fred Green. And our original music theme was created and performed by Golf Smarter listener Joe Beyer. Check out Joe's new album, Think Twice, on SoundCloud or at joebeyer.com. That's B-E-I-E-R. And finally, today's opening episode count was brought to you by Charlie and Vaughn. Please write a review for Golf Smarter wherever you subscribe, and follow us at Golf Smarter on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or if you prefer one-stop shopping, you can get all that information plus hundreds of videos and our complete archives at golfsmarter.com.